When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This episode of the Squawker Talker is brought to you by Beer 52. Beer 52 is the world's number one craft beer club and delivers crates of hand-picked craft beer to your door. Squawker Talker listeners can get £12 off a crate and two free beers by using the code SQUAWKER at checkout. So if you like a good deal on beer, visit beer52.com.
Hello everyone, hello football fans around the world, welcome to the Squawker Talker. It's pretty much 1 year of the Squawker Talker.
And what a year it's been.
What a year it's been.
It's been a great year. It's
been a great year. Mohammed Butt is here joining me.
I love being here. I love this room, it's so calming.
and Greg Johnson's
and cold.
Here.
I've been in this room for a year.
We've been bringing in food. Limited oxygen though, explains a lot. So we thought what we'd do today is there's a very, very big game this weekend which we absolutely have to talk about, Liverpool versus Arsenal. But we thought we'd give one of our most popular pods an old spin as well in the second part of the show.
A new spin, a second spin,
so stay tuned for that. But first of all, Saturday, 5:30, Liverpool versus Arsenal. Mo, a huge game. Two teams that are completely opposite. Liverpool are all about the big games this season. Arsenal, not so much.
No, and I mean, that really leads you to believe that Liverpool would probably win. But then Liverpool have been so bad lately. And Arsenal, both teams really need a win. It's like neither team could. It's the sort of game you could see becoming like a 0-0 draw or 1-1 draw, and both teams sort of been like, well, okay, but actually being secretly disappointed. But I mean, Arsenal can't afford to lose this game because they'll start slipping and sliding. Liverpool definitely need to get a win, get back on the saddle. It should make for a really open game, I think. I think both teams have to actually go for it. And Alexis Sanchez, we know how he loves the big occasion.
Yeah, Greg. I mean, it's weird that two such teams so full of talent with, you know, great teams in the Premier League are so short of form at the moment, and the confidence is so low for both of these squads.
Well, it's weird. It's like Liverpool are stuck in some weird sitcom, isn't it, really? it's like, oh, Ranieri gets sacked. Oh, unless they go and beat them.
Yeah.
They must be so happy that Wenger is clinging on to their life going, I'm going to stay. Because if he would have announced it, Arsenal would have been like, let's just beat Liverpool. Everybody else does when they sack their manager. So, you know.
It's quite an unpredictable game, and it has been in the past. The last time these two met was the first day of the season, an absolute thriller, 4-3 for Liverpool in the end at the Emirates. The key point of that game, Mo, was Sadio Mane ruining Nacho Monreal for 90 minutes. Can we expect Wenger to learn from that and try and put Gibbs in a bit more pace on the left flank?
I honestly have no idea. I mean, you would think so, but Wenger's shown a really, really quite remarkable ability to not learn from his mistakes in recent years. Like, he just makes the same problem, does the same thing over again. I mean, Monreal's had a really bad season, and honestly, you could probably trace it back to just getting absolutely wrecked on the first day. He's not been good at all. He's not recovered from that. He's like suffering from PTSD or something, and now he's got to face his demons now against Mane again. I don't know. I mean, if I was Wenger, I would throw Gibbs in, absolutely, because I think there's no way Monreal could face up to Mane again.
Gibbs himself suffering from PTSD from playing against Arjen
Robben. I mean, regardless of who you stick up against Sadio Mane, it's a one-on-one duel, and they're going to lose. The key to Sadio Mane is the guy who's on the left wing has to help the fullback. Otherwise, they're just going to absolutely get ruined. Sadio Mane is so quick, so good at beating his man.
Doesn't matter if you put David Alaba there. He's going to get into trouble.
So why not do a Unai Emery style double left-back system? Have Kieran Gibbs left
it's
wing.
It's Arsene Wenger, Mo. What are you talking about?
Do we think... I mean, looking at Liverpool's last game, Lucas Leiva had a torrid time against Jamie Vardy. Do we think Wenger's going to try and target that? Try and play Sanchez through the middle? Or maybe Welbeck?
He's got to play. He's got to play Alexis. He's got to start Welbeck if Welbeck is fit to play. Obviously, he skipped out on the Sutton game to avoid an injury. And I think you've got to put Welbeck in there at left wing. You've got to put Alexis up front. And you've got to run at that defence. Because they can't stand up to that at all. Mm. Without Mamadou Sakho in there, and without Dejan Lovren, or I don't know if he's fit, isn't he? I think he might be ready to play. I don't know. But even if he is, he's not going to be fully.
Even if he's Dejan Lovren.
He's not going to be sharp. You got to run at them. You got to get the ball, run at them, sit deep and hit them on the break. Alexis Sanchez was born to play against a defence like Liverpool's. I mean, it's just straight line balls over the top. And they can't handle pace and they can't handle energy or dribbling. I mean, Alexis Sanchez has all of that. You just put Mesut Ozil a bit deeper than normal and say, look, Mesut, get the ball, whack it over the top for Alexis. I mean, that's gold right there.
You were saying before that Arsenal aren't a team for big games. Danny Welbeck is a player for big games. He is a big game specialist. Yeah, I'm talking about. I mean, your man Kieran Gibbs was saying he's never seen Welbeck looking stronger. He even said to he kind of inferred that Welbeck's the only winner in the squad as well with his quotes in the week, which he kind of is. I mean, look at his trophies compared to Arsenal. But that's not meant as a dig, by the way. He did do very well at United. It wasn't. But I was talking then about how you're going to deal with Mane down the left, and Welbeck's exactly the kind of guy you want left wing because he's so good defensively. He's very tactically astute, very intelligent player, much more than people let on because he can sometimes like Bambi on ice, but forget that, he is brilliant. So yeah, Wenger needs to play him. And also, I mean, it's not going to happen because it's Arsene Wenger, but play a midfield three. Get Oxlade-Chamberlain in there and think of the link-up play with him pushing forward, Welbeck coming from the left. I mean, Liverpool's midfield is shakier than people think. You've got that two-man combination. Is Jordan Henderson going to be fit? I don't think he is, isn't he? It's going to be Emre Can again.
It's a massive doubt for the game, so it's probably going to be Emre Can.
If you've got Emre Can in a midfield two with Wijnaldum, even with Lallana coming back, get three Arsenal players in there, ping the ball around them. We don't stand a chance.
Never going to happen.
It's not going to happen,
is it? It's never going to happen.
I mean, Liverpool have kept only two clean sheets in the last 20 Premier League games against Arsenal. None in their 10 meetings at Anfield since the 1-0 win in 2006. I mean, Arsenal have to go for it. They have to really, because Liverpool can't stop them scoring, right? So Arsenal need to focus on just battering them. I mean, who knows if they'll keep a clean sheet? Probably not. Arsenal are a bit, in side of their mind against Gibbs just or Monreal or anyone. Just does not sound like a good matchup for Arsenal. But Arsenal can outscore Liverpool in this game. I firmly believe that because Liverpool's defence is terrible.
So much of the narrative, though, Liverpool, the wounded animal playing in a big game, Arsenal always struggle in the big games.
The wounded arse.
Yeah, the wounded arse, as it were. These two managers absolutely love each other.
Oh, yeah.
Mo, they are such big fans of each other.
How could you not love Arsene Wenger? I mean, unless you're an Arsenal fan and you think, oh, God, you're getting old, go away. But, you know, you look at what he's done in football, and if you're not like a fan of Arsenal and you're not being let down by what he's doing now, you love Arsene Wenger. I think Arsene Wenger's brilliant. What he did to English football is, and, you know, some of his quotes in interviews are just great. He's actually funny. You're much funnier than people let on. And then Klopp is just, I mean, good God, how could you not love Jurgen Klopp?
The man's a quote machine.
He's just so nice.
I'm sure we all saw it on that wonderful football satire comedy account on Twitter, The Banter Narrative. When Liverpool lost to Leicester, I think the headline was Jurgen Klopp finds new soundbite by which to deceive Liverpool fans and hide his flaws. Made me laugh a lot. No, but I think they're two fantastic managers. And I think we had James Benj, in our pod for our 20 Years of Wenger pod earlier this season. And he said if anyone was going to go to Arsenal, if you could have the pick of all the managers, it would be Jurgen Klopp to go there. And I think a lot of Arsenal fans, even with his struggles recently for Liverpool, would say similar. He's exactly the kind of manager they'd like to see.
Are they two sides of the same coin in certain ways? Because no,
I don't think so. No,
because in terms of career success, it's kind of it's mirroring.
I think idealism is what they have in common. They're both very idealistic coaches. They both don't really like to compromise what they do. I think otherwise, footballistically, if that's even, oh, I brought that back, didn't I? Yeah, footballistically, it's
single-handedly brought back footballistically.
Well, I coin it in an early pod. Anyway, whatever.
Are you bounce back abilitying footballistically? Is this
Footballistically, you know, they are very, very different. Polar opposites. Klopp is very much about energy, pressing, possession. Wenger is... I don't even know what Wenger's about these days. It's probably part
chemistry,
of the problem, really.
About player combinations and relationships and the human factor in football to bring about good one-touch football with beautiful, fluid and coherent attacking play. He trusts his players too much and doesn't believe in tactics. The poor, poor man.
Well, there you go. That's your answer.
Greg is not reading from a script right now.
No. My eyes glazed over there.
Off the cuff. If there's one thing, Greg, Arsenal are good at, it's securing top four status. Yeah. They are the kings of it. They did it with a midfield containing Diaby, Danilson, and not much else.
And also, when you look at those like early noughties squads, you forget how bad some of the teams were, don't you?
Awful, yeah.
Oh, really not just poor. Arsenal either. You look at some of the United teams, you're like, how did they win things?
I was looking the other day at the 11-12 squad, and beyond Robin Van Persie, there was scant
We've got
talent.
Dross in midfield, yeah. Dross in defence, Dross everywhere.
But this is the point, is that Arsenal Wenger is an absolute specialist at clearing top four. How can Klopp learn from this? Because his squad isn't amazing, and he's realistically, earlier on in the season, they were overachieving with this squad, weren't they?
No, not to sidestep your question, but I'm not sure there's too many answers that Klopp can find from what Wenger does, because I think their situations are so different. Even when Wenger was getting top four after the stadium move and he was having to kind of cut his cloth a bit, I still think the situation is so different to what Klopp's got at Liverpool. And I think in some ways, I know we've got this whole Arsenal fan TV and the kind of the negativity and criticism of Wenger. I still think even so, Liverpool fans have been far more demanding than Arsenal fans for so much longer. Mm. And there's a much higher appetite. I mean, look what happened to Brendan Rodgers. I mean, if he was at Arsenal, he'd probably still be there. Mm. I don't mean that in a dismissive way. Like, I just think at Liverpool, there's much more pressure. And I think I think in this similar way to how you're saying they're comparable as managers, I think there are parallels, but I think the actual real juiciness of their situation is very different. The actual tone, the character of the clubs, the demands, the expectations are very different. I think Klopp's going to be fine, though. I think the owners trust him. I think enough of the fans trust him. I think you've got the Kloppite guys that pop up every now and again, but I think he's a great manager.
You think he's
playing great
football.
Top
four for Liverpool this season?
You
think it's going to squeeze out United?
I think so.
United aren't getting in there, but I think City are. I think Spurs are. Chelsea are.
Arsenal are going to drop out?
The thing is, we say this every year, and it sounds absurd because Wenger's got his strongest squad ever.
This is what I was going to get at, Mo, is that if there's anyone who's a specialist at grinding out 10 wins out of 10 in the last part of the season.
Just before you go to Mo, one thing I was going to say is, in the past, Wenger was always getting top four in a top five race, but there is a genuine top six now, and they are all fully loaded with talent as well. Mm. And I that's what... Please go to Mo now. I just wanted to make that point, but that's what I think is different this year. But then it's Arsene Wenger.
The thing is, I was Arsenal going to get knocked out of Europe, right? In a week, right?
Yep.
Spurs are out of Europe, right? I thought Spurs were going to go a bit further in the Europa League, and then that would take their eye off the ball in the Premier League, and they'd drop points to drop out the top four. And I thought Arsenal would go in because they get knocked out by Bayern Munich. Now they're both going to get knocked out. Interesting to see how it unfolds now for me. I think United are going to stay where they are, sixth, because they've been sixth for about 50 million years. and Mourinho, as it goes on, I know he doesn't like to prioritise, quote-unquote, but as it goes on, the Europa League is going to stare him right in the face as an easy way to win the Champions League. And he drops too many City points in the league. I think Europa League is the way to go for United. So I think they'll stay where they are. I think it's genuinely between Arsenal and Spurs to drop out that top four, because I think Liverpool...
Spurs? I think second?
What's the point differential? I think Liverpool... There's something about them, man. I think once they start playing one game a week, once they get a win, Leicester was just a freak result. You know, Leicester did one of those very few games they played. We actually played like they did last season. I think once Liverpool get back on the horse, once they start winning, once Jordan Henderson gets back in the side in the middle of the park, I think one game a week they'll start to roll it out. Arsenal, you know, you never want to count out Arsenal Wenger for top four.
Everyone's now scared of predicting Arsenal to drop out the top four,
aren't
they?
Not me.
I just don't. I think Alexis Sanchez, it's classic Arsenal, right? The pressure is on for the pressure of months, and Arsenal sort of wilt under it. Pressure is going to come off. Mesut Ozil is going to come alive. Alexis Sanchez is going to finally find players playing up to his level and stop throwing such a massive hissy fit every single game. Mm. I think it'll just all start to come together for Arsenal, and they'll go on a bit of a roll and steamroller everyone and finish top four.
Mm. But I don't think Arsenal are going to get that chance. What I'm saying with the top six to top five, in the past they kind of got into this weird bit where people forgot about them, the pressure was off, and then they went on this run. People aren't going to forget about them now, because the pressure's on with another team competing that actually can compete. Mm. And just a quick, I know we're doing a short thing this time, but just to run through the fixture, I mean, United have got Bournemouth at home, you've got
City have got Sunderland away.
Yeah, Tottenham are hosting Everton.
Everton's a juicy game.
It is a juicy game, but I think Tottenham at home probably be all right. So I think that all the teams in the top six can go on a run. They probably all will go on a run in the same way to how United were kept in sixth even though they were winning. So I don't know. I think everyone's got a chance, and I just, out of all of them, I know it's a cliche, I doubt Arsenal's mental strength. So if anyone's going to falter, probably them.
Speaking of cliches, here's one. Quick fire prediction for the game, Mo?
2-1 Arsenal.
2-1 Arsenal?
My prediction for the fight? I don't know. Probably lots of goals.
Lots of goals?
Lots of goals.
Let's hope it's another 4-3, 4-all.
Nah. Wenger's too naive, Klopp's too aggressive.
Okay. Well, let's see how it goes. Let's see how it goes. As we mentioned for part two of this pod, we were going to give you a sort of a hark back to one of our most popular pods, featuring actually Greg Johnson. I was hosting it. It was our debate: who is the greatest out of Steven Gerrard, Paul Scholes, and Frank Lampard? We had Greg Johnson, James McManus, and Liam Toomey from ESPN FC on board. Please enjoy the pods. If you're looking for more sort of old stuff from our archive to look at, you can listen to any of Rory Briggs's one-on-ones or the football IQs. In the meantime, we'll be back on Monday. Greg will be here with the Monday Squawker Talker.
Oh yeah.
And please subscribe on iTunes, please follow us on Twitter, and we look forward to hearing from you very, very soon. Let's start off in a fairly obvious place. Is basically, I'm going to ask all three of our contributors how good their pick was at their best compared to the other two, and what did they excel at? James, I'm going to come to you first. How good was Gerrard at his peak?
I mean, he was probably a top five player in the world at his peak between 2007, 2008, 2010 era. Won games on his own in a pretty bogus team a lot of the time. Played with a lot of ropey players. What he excelled at was carrying a team not befitting of his talents a lot of the time. He was very malleable in terms of what kind of positions he played. He's people forget he started out as a holding midfielder next to Didi Hamann. Excelled in that role. Tried to use his pace a bit more. Played on the right wing. Played behind the front, behind Fernando Torres as a second striker. And did play centre midfield in a three pretty well as well. So I don't think either Paul Scholes or Frank Lampard could lay claim to playing that well in so many different positions. And he was occasionally okay out wide on the left wing as well.
Mm. Greg, would you contest that? I mean,
yeah, massively. But it's just wrong, isn't it?
Positional malleability, though. Gerrard's surely got the edge on.
No. Paul Scholes' peaks were higher in all the positions he did.
Which ones were they? Name more.
So he started
two.
Off as a second striker, then he went to attacking midfielder, then he became like more of a controlling midfielder.
In the 90s, they're essentially the same thing, aren't they?
Well. You look at what he's won as well, and you say that Gerrard was carrying a team. I mean, Gerrard was a bit of a mess. Like, just chaotic energy. I mean, he's great sometimes, but didn't really have the control that Scholes offered to his teams.
I mean, wasn't that a thing that just happened when he got older, though?
No, nope.
I don't remember Paul Scholes dictating a game up until about 2008.
No, he definitely did.
Maybe?
I mean, an early example is the 1999 FA Cup final when Roy Keane went off. The guy usually controlled games at United, and Scholes just picked up from where he left off. Really, he wasn't just a presence in the penalty box. Even from then, it was clear he had great vision. He could kind of see a game through and not use the ball and keep it, and yeah, put his team on top. So, I mean, what is Paul Scholes' peak? I mean, which peak do you want to pick? Because he's got about four.
He's also got 6 years when just no one accounts for, like between the...
What's Gerrard doing now? He's in LA, is he?
I was going to bring up, and Lee, I'm going to come to you, is that there is a big gap of Scholes stats, which were unfortunately not catered for, which is a bit unfair. It counts against him. But Liam, when it comes to peaks for a career, it's really hard to pick out one specific particular era for Lampard, because he just seemed to do it year after year after year.
Yeah, I think it was more a sort of band of years from about 2001 to 2006, and culminating when Chelsea won their second title and he finished second in the FIFA World Player of the Year voting behind only Ronaldinho.
Who was just, all right that year.
Yeah, you could say so. I mean, just so consistent over the course of that time. Set the record for consecutive Premier League appearances, 164 in a row, which is a remarkable physical achievement. But to do it with the quality that he showed, at least 20 goals in five consecutive seasons. Won big trophies for Chelsea in that time. You know, just he was at the peak of his powers, and I think it really showed.
James, weirdly enough, for someone who was defined by their consistency, Lampard's the only one of the three players to have picked up a Premier League Player of the Year award in 2004-2005. Gerrard never managed to do it. Scholes never managed to do it. Weirdly, players that are more remembered for, you know, in massive individual contributions.
I think Gerrard's won more Player of the Month awards than either Lampard or Scholes.
Versus four.
Yeah, and I think he's been in the PFA Team of the Year more times than Scholes and Lampard as
Correct.
Well. So if you're talking about his peers, I think they probably recognise Gerrard as at his peak, slightly ahead. But Lampard's consistency is amazing. I do think he probably does have the edge over Gerrard for that. But that's inherent in Gerrard's DNA, that he's not a consistent animal. And he didn't play in consistent teams, didn't have consistent roles. Lampard had a system catered to him, and fair enough, he definitely made the most of it. But I don't think Gerrard ever had a team built around him. He was always the spare part, the amazing world-class spare part. But
can you be a world-class spare part?
I don't think you can you? That's Paul, a contradiction
Paul
to him.
Paul Pogba?
Paul Scholes, mate. We'll talk about Paul Scholes. And we want to talk about, like, oh, Gerrard got so many players of the month. How many league titles did Paul Scholes get? He played for Man United. Yeah, because he was so good that he kept on top of his game for Man United, the most dominant team of his era in England. He didn't get in there just for fun. He didn't get in there for a favour. He was fantastic.
I don't think anyone's arguing that, though, are they?
Well, exactly. So if we're not arguing that, and we're talking about the inconsistency of Gerrard and all the excuses to excuse him for his flaws, I mean, Paul Scholes, he was just class, absolutely class for Man United.
The one thing I'd say about the sort of team being built around you argument is that certainly wasn't the case for Lampard at the start of his Chelsea career. Mm-hmm. He was a relatively unheralded arrival, although quite an expensive one at the time. And then because he wasn't an Abramovich signing, he had to prove himself over and over again, a new influx of players every summer, and he rose to the challenge each time. And I think his most impressive attribute over his entire career is just the improvement.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about high level performance. I mean, Lampard, out of the three, he's got more Champions League goals than Gerrard, which was quite surprising. Although Gerrard's got the edge on him on overall.
Yeah, we had to qualify a lot of times for the Champions. A lot of TNS solutions away from home.
Yeah, but one interesting thing, Greg, picking up on Scholes is he wasn't a penalty taker for Chelsea, Lampard FC, and Gerrard FC, which means that overall per game, his actual goal scoring was better than Gerrard, which was quite interesting.
It doesn't surprise me. No. Just class player, isn't it?
Given that he played deeper, you might not associate that. But he had an unbelievable knack of getting goals.
Yeah, and he just sums up. This is true of Lampard and fair Gerrard as well. It's just the intelligence of all three of these players in terms of their timing of runs, their awareness of where to be at the right time to catch things. But I think, having said that, all three of the players were fantastic at that. But I think Paul Scholes, you look at the type of goals he scored, there was no coincidence that the amount of like volleys from outside the box he got. Like, he just knew exactly where to be to basically take advantage of these situations. And yeah, I mean, Paul Scholes scores goals. It's the chant at Old Trafford, and he might have started out as like a second striker, if you want to call it. But even when he's playing from deep, I mean, he's probably the most complete player in terms of actual technical abilities of all three. And even when he was playing a deep line role, he could still move up at the right time, pick his moment, and just get the shot in. And some of the quality of the strikes he did, just the sheer technique on the volleys and just putting his foot through a shot as well.
I think for volleys outside the box, I think that there could be an entire hour dedicated to a Gerrard Scholes debate. Let's move on a bit. Let's talk about importance to the team. And this is something that James brought up. I mean, in the last years of Gerrard's career at Liverpool, there was definitely the argument, it's like, there was a reluctance to drop him despite the dip in performance and the slight loss of pace because he had been so important to the team. I mean, for so many years, there was no Liverpool without Steven Gerrard.
I mean, you take Steven Gerrard out of that Liverpool team and they're winning practically nothing, really, for about 15 years. You take Scholes out of that Man United team, they're still going to win a couple of league titles, aren't they? You take Lampard out of that Chelsea team, with the amount of money they had, they're probably still going to win a title or two. So I think if we're talking about impacts on their teammates, it has to be Gerrard, like, hands down. I remember I was at a Merseyside derby when I was about 14, and Liverpool had Antonio Nunes on the right wing. Steven Gerrard picked the ball up, losing 2-1 to Everton at the time. Gerrard picked the ball up, pinged it out wide to Antonio Nunes, looked up, realised who he'd passed it to. Ran over there and took it off him. So that's the sort of player he was playing with. We got Antonio Nunes for a bag of chips and 8 million with Michael Owen, basically. And he was terrible. But right back that day was Hosomi. Centre backs that day were Salif Diao and Igor Biscan. Can any of Paul Scholes and Frank Lampard say they had to play with that sort of calibre of player? Well, then, week in, week out?
They were in a better squad and they were still getting picked regularly. So I think that's actually not the argument you probably want to make about Gerrard, because he was a big fish in a small pond. being picked by default, whereas...
Small pond, Liverpool. Yeah. That's a ridiculous claim.
No, not really.
Absolutely ridiculous.
You've just said he was playing in terrible teams, so by default, the talent wasn't there. So therefore, if he's the star player, I mean, Scholes and Lampard were still getting picked in teams despite having better players around them.
But that doesn't invalidate James's argument that without Scholes, Man United are still going to win a lot of trophies in that era,
probably not as many.
Probably not as many. Wouldn't have won the treble without him.
Definitely wouldn't have won the treble. Wouldn't have won the Champions League without him.
You can make that argument about every midfielder in that United.
No, I agree. And what I'm saying is that you take Scholes out of United, but the fact that United didn't take Scholes out of United, they signed Varane and he still kept his place. He basically pushed Varane out of the team. Varane was much better than people remember. He really, really was. But Scholes was like, no, I'm back. I'm get this guy away. I'm going to be the playmaker again. Mm. So this idea that, you know, Gerrard played all the time in a worse team. Well, great. Scholes was in a better team and still kept his place.
Liam, I mean, do you subscribe to James's view that effectively Lampard, yeah, he fought, as Greg said, he fought well to keep his place in the team, but without Lampard, Chelsea would have still had quite a lot of success. It wasn't entirely reliant on Lampard.
Well, I mean, I agree in the sense that Liverpool did lean on Gerrard probably more heavily than United and Chelsea leaned on Scholes and Lampard. But a couple of things to say about that. First of all, Lampard was not just a key player, but a leader of that team for about 10 years. And it was a team that often kind of managed itself as managers came and went with great frequency. He set the tone in the dressing room as well as on the pitch. And the first 2 years that they won the title, he was actually the top scorer. So,
Is his role as a leader alongside John Terry as vice captain? It's kind of understated a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean they were effectively co-captains for most of that era. Terry wore the armband and was the face as the homegrown guy. But there's a reason why Frank Lampard's name is still sung at every Chelsea match by the fans. He's probably held maybe an even higher regard, or at least equal, because he was every bit as much of a leader out front and behind the scenes at the club.
And Chelsea's all-time top scorer.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is just absurd when you think about it.
Well, how many clubs can you say that for, that the all-time top scorer is a midfielder? It's absolutely crazy. And he's the fourth all-time Premier League scorer, which is another just insane...
That is balmy.
Mm. I mean, we're talking about goals a lot here, but I mean, we were talking before about how Gerrard, when he got older, he was playing his deep-lying role. And it didn't really end too well with him. I mean, obviously, there was a slip and all that, but there were clear issues with how he played that role, because it wasn't quite... positionally as smart as maybe need to be. Whereas you compare to Paul Scholes, when he came back after having already retired once, he came back and even his last season he was making 97.17 passes per 90, and that was from 16 appearances. This wasn't like he played once for 45 minutes and the maths have gone all haywire, and that was a 92% pass accuracy rate. I think only Carrick this season, having only played two games, has come close to that per 90 rate over the past, what is it, five seasons. So even at that age when he couldn't run, and this is something Gerrard struggled to cope with, he's still overplaying, he's still overdoing that time. Scholes had the intelligence and the nous to kind of realise, you know, no, I'm going to calm down, I'm going to do it. I mean, to be fair, Lampard tried as well, and neither of them succeeded in evolving themselves at a later stage as Scholes did. And I think that really sums up his improvement, his impact on the team, on like a mental capacity as well as on a technical capacity.
Well, we're going to get to weaknesses shortly, but I want to ask James about impact on the teammates. How did, from your point of view, Gerrard enhanced the teammates around him? Because obviously, as you've mentioned several times, he was playing, you know, with Salif Jow, Igor Biscan. How did he raise the general level of the squad, or was it just easy being the best player on the pitch every time?
I mean, he wasn't always the best player on the pitch. Gerrard didn't always play in absolutely terrible teams. Like, there was the Didi Haman, Gerard Houllier era, where fairly decent side, finished second in the league. There was Rafa Benitez team with Alonso Mascherano. But he helped attract a quality of player to the club that, if he hadn't have been there, Liverpool wouldn't be where they are now. They'd have fallen a lot further in that time. Mm. He always says that Xabi Alonso is his favourite ever central midfield partner. And I think if you asked Alonso, he'd probably say Gerrard as well. Because
serious bromance there.
Yeah, because they get the best out of each other. I'm not saying like Scholes isn't going to have one like that, Lampard's not going to have one like that. But it was more building something from nothing Gerrard was having to do. Maybe at a level Scholes and Lampard probably didn't have to. Mm. It wasn't as much on them. Mm. They were a key component, but they weren't the only one trying to make it happen, basically.
Mm. Liam, I mean, in terms of, you know, we prepare an agenda for this pod every single week, and the actual question I've got is, how do they enhance the abilities of those around them besides being a match winner? And it's personally, as a football fan, it's what I remember Lampard most for. He always seemed to get the crucial goal in a 2-1 win or a 3-2 win or a 1-0 win. How did he influence the players around him? Obviously, he was a leader in the dressing room, as you stated previously, but on the pitch, did he have such a marked effect on the teammates around him? Did he support the team well on the pitch?
I think while John Terry was probably the pointer and the shouter,
very
by
good
and
at
large.
That.
Yeah. Carragher at Liverpool's joke.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's always one. But I think Lampard was more of a lead by example type.
Mm.
And I mean, he was so consistently good that his performances instantly raised the level of the team because everyone else around him was forced to try and play at his level. And he was always, if not the best player on the pitch, one of the two or three best players on the pitch usually.
Mm.
A big example of him kind of leading when he wasn't necessarily the match winner was the Champions League final in 2012.
Mm.
I mean, he was clearly towards the end, his powers were on the wane, and he had to play a very restricted role in that game at the base of midfield, which is not what you'd associate Lampard with at all. Chelsea barely got over the halfway line, but he defended superbly in that game. He made sure Chelsea defended superbly in that game, despite the absence of Terry and having two centre-backs that were basically hobbled for 120 minutes. So I think that speaks really well of him and his leadership qualities on the biggest of all stages.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, same question. I think you're fairly keen to answer. In terms of impact on their teammates, I mean, there were so many leaders and world-class players that came in and out of the door while Scholes was at United, and never was he ever heralded as the best player in the team, which is unique for these three players. He's the only one of the three that was never the best player at the club or considered as such. What impact did he have on his teammates?
I think that's true of critics, but I think you actually listen to what a lot of people play with him. I'm not going to reel out all those.
I didn't know Scholes had any critics.
No, but I think what I'm saying is like people outside of the club like looking, oh, he's not Beckham, he's not this and that. And I'm not going to reel out all the stupid Zidane quotes and all that nonsense. But when people talk about when they were playing at Man United, they always talk about Scholes' technique stood out. And I also am not going to bring out that awful story about hitting some guy while I was having a whiz down the tree.
Because there's about 40 of them.
If anything, that sums up the quality of storyteller at Old Trafford, which is clearly not good enough, right? But even Ronaldo talked about it, Keane talked about all these really driven, high demanding players talking about how impressive Scholes was. And like you say with Lampard, I think he just helped keep the level in training and on the pitch high on a technical level, because what he could do with ball was impressive. Everyone wanted to try and get up there with him. But also, as well as impact on his teammates, impact on his rivals. I mean, we talked about Alonso there and Gerrard, but Alonso has called Paul Scholes the ideal, as most Spanish people have. I did say I wasn't going to do the Zidane thing, didn't I? But
Fell into the trap.
I have, yeah. Yeah, his impact on his teammates might not be as obvious with the goals or with the kind of like tub thumping, fist in the air stuff. But yeah, I mean, yeah, he's like the technical benchmark.
He's the most booked player in Champions League history. He's fourth on the list of Premier League bookings. Yeah, he's the most booked player. Yeah. 32 yellow cards in the Champions League, which is absurd when you think about it. I mean, is there an argument that kind of his lack of discipline, Paul Scholes, had a negative effect on his teammates and on his team?
I don't think so, no. I think that's kind of there was always a mean streak to United that was kind of part of what made them good, so nah.
We're going to get into weaknesses, actually, a little bit later, but first I want to... So far, we've been simmering away. James and Greg have had a couple of nibbles at each other, but now we're going to talk about contribution to the England national team.
This isn't going to go well for anyone, is it?
This is going to go well. I'm going to start with Liam just to save us a bit of time. Sure. Contribution to England. All three were arguably underwhelming for England, but how was Lampard better for the three lines in your estimation?
Always a difficult task, isn't he?
Mm.
He's always available. Which is, I think,
the
base level. Always available. England's most prolific penalty taker.
True.
One of only a handful of centurions, I think.
Mm.
England's most prolific goal-scoring midfielder, which doesn't surprise anyone.
One goal fewer than Alan Shearer.
Yeah, I mean, and there were some big goals along the way. One famously that didn't happen against Germany in 2010, but he scored the equaliser against Portugal in 2004 to take the game to penalties. And yeah, I mean, there weren't really many big moments, but I don't think there were in Scholes' career or Gerrard's. That's more of a reflection of England's last decade than anything else. He played reasonably consistently despite the massive criticism and the massive structural failings in the English game. And I'm not sure how much more people could have expected in the circumstances.
Mm. Well, That's an interesting way of putting
that's
it.
I think that's as good as I can make it.
James, I mean, would you argue that Gerrard was the best of the three in terms of contribution to England?
It's close run thing between Gerrard and Lampard. I don't think Scholes is like close.
Mm.
But Gerrard's longevity, similar argument to Lampard. Gerrard was always great in qualifying and again asked to play unfamiliar roles. Mm. Started out as a holding man, played on the left in 2008-09 when he was playing second striker behind for Liverpool. Scored a lot of important goals in qualifying, especially away from home, the 2010 run-up. I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because essentially all three of them are massive letdowns at international level given their talent. But I'm finding it really hard to champion it too much.
Really?
But he was a very good captain, I thought.
Yeah? There's many who disagree with that.
Stuart Pearce is one of them. So if you want to argue on the side of him, go ahead. So. But... it's a tricky argument to make, but it's a close one for him between Gerrard and Lampard.
You know what I thought as well? I don't know if anyone had really covered this over the last few years, but I'm not sure Gerrard and Lampard were really that compatible in midfield.
Yeah, no, I've never...
I don't know.
It's odd. It's odd how they never complemented each other.
Yeah.
What's even weirder is that maybe we never saw a Scholes-Gerrard-Lampard midfield three.
Triumvirate.
It was literally the most easy decision ever to make, but we had to play David Beckham, so it was contractually obliged in every younger manager's contract, probably. So.
I'd actually agree. Like the problem wasn't fitting those three in. Was fitting wingers in that were kind of outdated in the game. But anyway, that's another argument for another time. But
Greg Scholes, arguably, and most people would agree, had an extremely disappointing England career given his talent and his technique on the ball, something which we're not renowned for on the international stage at all.
Mm. Well, yeah, he's the kind of player that England apparently don't produce. That's simply what it is. And it is mainly disappointing because of how good he looked early on as well, especially under Glenn Hoddle. You might argue is the kind of England player that England don't produce anymore as well. So maybe he had a bit of a kind of a thing for him there. But out of the three, this is a really cheap shot. I'm going to go for it. He's the only England player to win a semi-major international honour, Latourney, 1997, the front runner to the Confederations Cup warm-up for the France World Cup in 98. Paul Scholes was there, won it.
So it's the seat warmer for the seat warmer competition.
How many seat warmers have your guys won, eh? Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's
just moving over that.
Yeah, just Greg is trying to change the subject.
Just let him die on his own.
Desperately.
<lads.
laughs> I mean, there is a question to be asked. I mean, why did Paul Scholes not come out of retirement?
Asked by four different managers too.
Four different managers who, and England would have been so immeasurably better.
What a baby.
For his contribution.
Played me on the left for four games. I'm retiring.
Meh. I don't know. I think there is a general United feeling that it's club before country, both within the fans and I'd probably say a lot of the players as well. So I don't know. I think he's quite happy with what he did for his club, really. I don't think there's that much disappointment that it didn't quite work out. I think he did what he did, and Paul Scholes is, I mean, we see him as a pundit now. He's not exactly, you know, he's got his ideas, hasn't he? So
yeah, he's a stubborn man.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he just got to a point and thought, nah, you're all right.
He's got his ideas.
That might be a personality flaw. That might be a failing, and he didn't do it for the boys, for England or whatever. But I don't know. I don't think you can do it as a mark against him so much as a player.
Well, yeah. He didn't miss a huge amount, did he?
No.
That's a good point.
And if he would have come back, he still would have been crammed into a midfield that didn't suit him or any of the other players around him. Mm. So he wouldn't have sold anything.
Him and Scott Parker.
Yeah, the Capello era would have been Scholes and Barry in centre mid.
Yeah.
That would have been, wow. That would have been
slow. You talk about yellow cards. Wow. Ooh.
That'd have been a real treat. Let's move on to weaknesses. The guys struggled through that round. Really, really struggled.
That was the weaknesses round, wasn't it?
It's England. Always.
Liam, let's talk about weaknesses. And we're not talking about, you know, particularly in terms of poor parts of their career, but in terms of aspects of the game, because these were three very complete players, which is why everyone loved to watch them. What were the weaknesses to Lampard's game? What was missing from his locker?
Well, I'm tempted to say athleticism, but I don't mean in terms of fitness, because he was extraordinarily fit, but just not an explosive athlete. No, certainly not as dynamic as someone like Gerrard.
Mm.
But what he was just a supreme professional.
Mm.
Also, I think, alluding to what Greg said earlier, I think he probably wasn't as successful as Scholes at reinventing his game in his later careers. Although he did do something slightly differently from Gerrard and Scholes, in that rather than moving back, he kind of moved forward. in his last season at City,
should have done, to be honest.
And became almost the second striker at City, either starting or off the bench, and got a lot of goals in that season.
He was superb for City. Really.
Yeah, if there was one thing he could still do, it was score.
Do you remember his face when he scored against Chelsea? He looked like he'd run over his own cat. Yeah. I felt so sorry for him.
It was very funny.
That I've left the oven on face.
Yeah, yeah. Oh God, what have I done? What would you say were the greatest weaknesses of Scholes and Gerrard?
I think Gerrard was the least successful at reinventing himself. I think when he played at the base of midfield for Liverpool's title challenge, I think he was good from a leadership point of view, scored a lot of penalties and got a lot of assists, particularly from set pieces, but the team conceded 50 goals and he was the midfield shield. So I think that tells you all you need to know. In the second season, he just kind of, his form kind of collapsed, and he was done a little bit earlier than Lampard, I think, because he couldn't quite adapt as well. Scholes' weaknesses, I don't think he found it as easy to necessarily seize a game in the same way. Gerrard could win games on his own. Lampard could score crucial goals to win games. I feel like Scholes could control games, but he wouldn't necessarily dominate them and win them.
James, would you agree with Liam's assessment of Gerrard's weaknesses?
I think Gerrard's biggest weakness is that he's a different player in his head to the one that he was with his body. In his head, he thought he'd be this central midfield. He thought he was Xabi Alonso in his head, basically. He could play deep, spray passes, and he always thought he was that. Under Rafa Benitez, he was like, why are you playing me out wide on the right? Oh, wait, it's your best ever Liverpool season. Yeah. So managers knew Gerrard better than he knew himself. His biggest weakness is that he just didn't really know what sort of player he was, which I think is probably why he aged quite badly and couldn't reinvent himself, because he never really got over that in his head, even when he was at his peak, basically.
It's really interesting, sort of the fallout from especially the failed title run and the years subsequent to him afterwards, and sort of lead up leaving Liverpool. There's been a lot of articles about Gerrard's mentality in general, and it seems to have been a real issue for him to overcome during his career, both in terms of how he saw himself as a player and the expectation he placed on himself.
Yeah, I think it's a similar issue probably John Terry had under Rafa Benitez at Chelsea, and that's why Carragher retired under Rodgers, because he couldn't take not being first choice. It's a matter of pride, basically, isn't it? Gerrard was used to being the first name in the team sheet, especially being a local boy. Another Gerrard weakness would have to be positional ill-discipline at times, which kind of feeds into the doesn't really know what kind of player he is. The managers have got the best out of him with the strict disciplinarians. So Gerard Houllier gave him a holding role. Didi Haman, box to box a bit more, very good. And Rafa Benitez, you played him out on the right and second striker. Brendan Rodgers, a young manager with a young team, couldn't really stand up to Steven Gerrard. He basically just said, where do you want to play? And Steven Gerrard went, finally, someone's going to let me play in the Xabi Alonso role. And he did it, and it didn't work. What Gerrard should have done as he got older was move forward, because I think Gerrard is probably the best one-on-one finisher England's produced in probably the last 10 years. You ever see him miss a one-on-one? That's actually what Gerrard Houllier said about 5 or 6 years ago. He said, I think Gerrard should move further forward, become an actual striker. But the difference is with playing your back to goal, I think he probably could have overcome him. But again, it's a pride issue with Gerrard, which again is probably another weakness.
Greg, Scholes is arguably probably the most complete in terms of ability out of the three players. He's kind of, you know, got it all on paper. But what would you say his weakness is? I think tackling, we can just all agree that his tackling was atrocious.
I'd actually say on the pitch anyway, on a mental and technical level, yeah, I'd say he's the most complete. But athletically, he's asthmatic. That's also not a dig. That's an actual medical fact. I'd say that he wasn't an athlete, but he used his skills in other parts of the game to basically mean that wasn't an issue. Tackling. But I don't go along the idea it was a bad tackler. I think he meant every single foul he ever did.
I think he did as well.
Massively dirty player.
I will say with Scholes, I think there's this period in his career where he went from this attack midfielder to this dictator from deep that is massively glossed over by everyone because he ended on a high. Gerrard's Liverpool career ended on a big low note, didn't it? Gerrard's never going to be lower rated in history than he is right now. And Scholes is probably rated higher than he ever was during his career, because he came back and he won the title and he was still good.
But I don't think you can dismiss that. I think, one of the
This reinvention took a lot longer than people.
But you also got to take into account the context of the reinvention. Like, he basically went blind in one eye and had to go for an operation. That's one of the reasons why he dipped out in his form. Mm. Like, he actually had quite a serious physical problem that almost meant he had to stop playing football altogether. So in some ways, Scholes came back from two retirements to some extent, because that could have actually ended his whole career. Mm. But he went away. He had a bit of treatment. He got it sorted.
Cheesy.
No, but I didn't mean to be cheesy. It is true. Like, the guy was pretty much half blind and then came back after having a treatment. And he reinvented his game, got back into the team, became the catalyst once again. So I don't think that's something to kind of go, he had a dip. I think you've really got to be impressed by how he did come back and he reinvented himself once again.
Do you agree with Liam's assessment that Scholes sometimes struggle to dominate games in the same way that Lampard and Gerrard did?
Definitely.
Maybe,
I think
maybe a weakness of his.
That comes down to the athleticism point. Mm. Yeah, definitely. He wasn't box-to-box like the other two guys could be. But then the idea that, oh, we did control games. Well, I think that we said earlier, like, oh, the kind of player England don't produce anymore. That ability to control games is still underrated, I think, in the Premier League. And we still look mainly to foreign players to do that for our teams. So, yeah, I wouldn't disagree. But I also think that controlling isn't like a booby prize. That's a pretty decent quality as well.
How would you assess Gerrard and Lampard's weaknesses? We heard James talking about Scholes' weaknesses.
I think it's pretty spot on. I think I've always said Steven Gerrard is probably the most, both athletically and whatever you want to call it, like naturally gifted, probably the most world-class player England produce, but also the least well-coached England player we've had at the top level, like, over since I've been watching football.
But it's coached, like, as a footballer, or like coached like in terms of,
well, I think both. Mentally, I think James is spot on in terms of like how Gerrard sees himself and how he actually is as a player and how his manager saw him. And I just think you look at, especially later on in his career, you kind of look at the holes that started opening up in his game when he couldn't cover it with pace and power. And I think that sums up the kind of foundation that was lacking. I'm not blaming the coaching, because I think, as we said at the start of the pod, Liam, like, he's probably not a very easy player to coach either. Mm. So I think that the issue was that he never got that technical foundation drilled into him, which you need to kind of keep it going later on. Mm. I think by contrast, I think Lampard was all about that technical foundation. Like, he's such a precise player. But I'd say Lampard's kind of weakness was, I think, in some ways, he wasn't limited, but I think his strengths were quite narrow. He had quite a narrow band of strengths. Like, he was a goal-scoring midfielder. I don't think he ever excelled in the kind of controlling role that Scholes. And to be fair, Gerrard could do, but Gerrard did it. This is the thing, Gerrard controlled games with power. I think Scholes controlled games with his head a bit more.
Okay. Final category to discuss here. That one iconic performance. Leo, I'll come to you first. It's kind of odd with someone like Frank Lampard, because he is Mr. Consistent. But if you had to pick out one performance, I mean, any come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there are fewer of what you might call like the A-plus performances, you know, where you just win a game on your own. Partly because he was rarely required to do that, because Chelsea had a really strong spine. But if there was one I had to pick, probably Bolton away in 2005. Chelsea weren't champions yet. They hadn't been champions in 50 years. And all the pressure was on them. Even though they had a little bit of breathing space, it's getting over that final hump. And the fact that he was the guy who took control, scored both goals in the win.
Away from home, tricky Bolton
side.
Yeah,
away from home. Bolton were, it's easy to forget nowadays, but they were a pretty tricky Premier League assignment back then.
Who was their manager? Forgotten about
that him. One. Yeah, redacted. but I think that was probably his defining, the one that he'd probably look back on with the most fondness.
Mm. James, I think I know what you're going to answer, but that one iconic performance.
There isn't one. First off, because he's the most iconic player here. He dealt in the A plus moments. He was very dramatic and cinematic in his style of play, and that was reflected in the sort of narrative that he gave everyone weekly, almost. It's got to be Istanbul, wasn't it? But the Olympiacos game, the West Ham game, basically any time Liverpool won anything, it was because of him and an iconic moment.
Yeah.
I don't know what I have to say anymore. This is such a clear winner here. It's
Greg, iconic performance, Scholes?
No. I think Scholes' iconic performance is almost like
away at Wimbledon with that volley.
No. So in the second leg against Barcelona in 2008, when he scored the winning goal, kind of shinned it actually, but we're not going to talk about the goal. What was great about Scholes on both legs actually was just the way he controlled the game. He wasn't doing that many tackling. It was all about closing down the space, controlling the tempo of the game. I think he was 34 at that time, I think. And you look at, I mean, I don't want to be like, but you look at what Gerrard was doing at 34. He was slipping to let Chelsea go and score the goal. That
such a cheat. Was,
no, but it's true, though. I mean, it goes back to a saying, like, Gerrard...
His feet still worked. He just fell over.
Well, you admit yourself on the weakness. It's the positional ill discipline. It's the
long
inability
starts.
To...
Is that the weakness?
Positional ill discipline. As Liam said as well, the goals conceded in that role. You look at what Scholes was doing, having reinvented himself from a second striker to an attacking midfielder, to what you want to call him. At this point, he was getting to the end of his career, and I actually think that's the greatest performance he ever put in a United shirt. He scored the winning goal, but it was everything else he did in the game. He closed down all the passing angles. He controlled the tempo. He didn't let Xavi or Iniesta get anywhere near him. He was absolutely fantastic. And I just think you look at what he was doing at 34 compared to the other players, and it just sums up for me.
I think that in itself proves my main criticism of Scholes, this massive rewriting of history that we're basically going to evaluate Scholes' entire career built off the last 6 years and the fact he came back and won the title. So his best performances were all in that last 6 years, because that's ones we can remember. So I think that's my main criticism. There's just, what about the 6 years before that? Obviously the box-to-box midfielder days, second striker days, brilliant, 20 goals a season. What about the 3 years after that, four years after that?
When he benched Veron, and before that, when he won the FA Cup in 1999. Yeah, pretty good.
No, I meant after that. What about 2001, 2002, 2003?
That's what I mean. That's when he benched Veron, isn't it?
It's clear. The three of you have all argued your cases very well. It's clear you're not going to agree on who your first choice, who you think is the best out of the three of these. But we've devised a way of figuring out who is actually the best, because I'm going to ask all of you individually, who's the second best out of the three? And that's how we're going to figure this out. I am going to go to Mr. Greg Johnson first. Who's the second best out of Gerard Lampard's goals, in your opinion?
I'm really sorry, Liam. It's Steven Gerrard.
Steven Gerrard. Wow.
I think one thing I will say is that all three of these players are the absolute perfect and best ideal embodiment of their type of British midfielder. Absolutely. In England anyway. I think you can't touch Gerrard for box-to-box midfielder out of this three. Like, he's absolutely incredible. What he did, I mean, as James said, he was all about the A-plus moments. And people would mock him, saying Hollywood balls. Well, Steven Gerrard was a Hollywood footballer. Like, he had all the big moments. He was blockbuster. I'd say that...
He's now playing in Hollywood.
Well, he is. That's a very good point. What a link.
Thanks, mate. But
I set him up. But what I would say is that, even I'm going to... you know, bring a negative thing in, because I've got to, because I've got to protect Scholes' honour. But outside the Hollywood moments, that's where I think the cracks appeared. Maybe when the script wasn't written for him in the way it needed to be to deliver his lines. I'm not going to go down that route anymore. But I'd say Steven Gerrard, but as I said, world-class player, but poorly coached and just didn't quite have the foundation to do it. But he would be my second choice.
James, second choice out of the three. Who are you going to go for?
As a surprise, me and Greg are going to agree. We're going to back each other up. I'm going to go for Paul Scholes.
Really?
Yeah.
This is outrageous.
I was fully expecting Frank Lampard to win via this methodology.
I admire Frank Lampard.
Non-tactical voting. This is beautiful.
I admire Frank Lampard for what he did. I think Frank Lampard achieved the best out of himself, which sounds patronising. I don't mean it that way, because look how many goals he scored. Just look at the sheer volume of goals he scored. He was a freak. But like Greg said, he did have a narrow skill set. So he was very good. Which is good. It's like he's Stephen Hendry, if I give you a snooker analogy. Paul Scholes is Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Right.
So I mean, both
the best ever, mate. I'll take that.
One's got 7 world titles. The other one's got 6. But if you'd ask any snooker player which one did they base their game on, they'd say Paul Scholes. So Paul Scholes for me.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Didn't expect that snooker analogy.
I didn't expect you to go for Paul Scholes. Wow. I didn't expect the snooker analogy. There's so much. I'm bowled over. Liam, Frank Lampard, not ignored by both. I was fully expecting him to run away with this, with that sort of second best methodology. It reminds me that I was watching if you can find it, there's a compilation of Frank Lampard's best assists on YouTube somewhere, and it's absurdly good. Mm. Absurdly talented player. You must be gutted.
Seething. Yeah, well, I feel like he's not been given the credit that he deserves in this room. But
well, you lost, so who's your second best?
I would say Gerrard.
So close.
I feel like you can, in terms of career achievement and ability, you can sort of throw a coat over all three of them. But I would put Gerrard second, just because of his natural ability and his all round skill set, and as Greg said, like the sort of iconic moments that he had in his career.
Okay. Wow.
Can I just say that Paul Scholes would control the coat better and fold it more neater? That's my
Gerrard's got a bigger coat, though.
Oh.
Gerrard would lob it somewhere and lose it and then get a better coat.
And the story behind how he did it would be fantastic.